jobbe med fri programvare til å samarbeide bedre, og ikke minst hjelpe oss og andre beslutningstakere I privat og offentlig sektor til å ta gode og informerte valg. Så vi altså veldig glad for at senteret nå oppe å stå, og vil helt sikkert spille en viktig rolle fremover. Så det altså sånn at I tillegg til på en måte det mer, hva skal jeg si, det liksom funksjonelle og matnyttige delene av fri programvare, så det også for regjeringen, når vi har vært så opptatt av det hele veien, fra Soria Moria-erklæringen via stortingsmeldingen og friprodusentene, så det også en annen, mer underliggende grunn. Og det altså at fri programvare og, la meg si, omliggende herligheter og diskusjoner, og representerer en kultur, noen verdier, og med på å skape noen utviklingstrekk I samfunnet, som vi mener grunnleggende positive og viktige. Og la meg gå og si litt om det. For det første så har bruken av fri programvare og det iboende I seg, at det representerer en kultur av deling. Det kanskje ingen bombe for dere at vi I SV opptatt av det med deling. Men det utover rent det å fordele gode, det også, det har iboende I seg det, at det å dele på informasjon, det å samarbeide om utvikling, fungerer eller gir effektivitet og større framskritt og raskere utvikling. Sånn at det å dele, det innebærer både at man kan få et fortrinn I form av utvikling og effektivitet. Ikke minst kan det også innebære at tilgjengeligheten blir større for mange. Og så tror vi også selvsagt at sånn direkte for offentlig sektor, så vil det også være store fordeler med bruk av fri programvare, at vi gradvis kan øke bruken av det. Så en annen kultur som viktig I her, og det at det med på å skape en kultur for deltaking. Og på fredag som var, så la jeg fram nytt forslag til formålsparagraf for skole og barnehager I Norge. Og et av hovedpoengene, et av de viktigste endringene I formålsparagraf for skole, det at man vektlegger veldig sterkt at vi ønsker at elever skal være aktive, at de skal være med å skape, utvikle, at man skal være deltakere og ikke tilskuere og mottakere I skolen. Og det interessant, fordi jeg mener på mange måter at den samme kulturen også iboende I fri programvare og bruken av det. At man faktisk avhengig av menneskene som deltakere for å komme videre. Bare for å utvide perspektivet litt, så gjelder det samme etter mitt syn og hele diskusjonen, eller utviklingen av ulike sosiale programvarer, altså diskusjonen rundt Web 2.0. Det har det iboende I seg at det gjør oss mer til deltakere enn bare mottakere og tilskuere. Og det mener jeg har perspektiver I seg langt utover selve nettet og selve friprogrammer. La meg gi et eksempel fra, som jeg har kikket litt nærmere på og blitt veldig fascinert av. Fordi I 2003 så dukket det opp en fullstendig ukjent politiker I USA. Han var guvernør I en av de aller minste delstaterne I USA, Vermont. Han heter Howard Dean. Han var på det tidspunktet, altså han hadde null støtte, han var fullstendig ukjent, hadde ingen stab, ingen oppslutning. Nå I dag så han leder av det demokratiske partiet I USA. I løpet av, fra våren 2003 til utgangen av året, under den demokratiske nominasjonen, så gikk han fra å være en kandidat fullstendig uten å støtte, til å være den kandidaten som ledet og hadde størst oppslutning på meningsmålingene. Nå hører vi til historien at han ble jo ikke den demokratiske presidentkandidaten til slutt. Han endte sin nominasjon med et stort skrik, eller en sånn episode da, som så ble vist på TV overalt I USA. Men han mobiliserte altså enorm støtte og er da fortsatt en ledende politiker blant demokraterne I USA. På hvilket grunnlag skjedde det? Jo, først og fremst ved å mobilisere støtte fra veldig unge mennesker gjennom nettet. De sto helt I fronten av å bruke, og var tidlig ute med å bruke blogging. De dannet nettsamfunn som vokste og ble enormt store. De begynte innsamling av midler, altså I USA så det å samle inn penger, ikke sant? Det en svær del av valgkampen. Det skjer vanligvis via liksom at man har middager med big business og så videre. De samlet inn små beløp av enkeltpersoner via nettet. Og gjorde, gjennom det klarte de å slå de som samlet inn med store summer fra big business den måten. Og de brukte nettet til å koble opp folk, lagde såkalte meetups, som både foregikk på nettet, men som også da ble satt ut I livet med fysiske møtesteder rundt omkring I USA. Han som var kampanjesjefen til Howard Dean, han har jeg møtt selv, han heter Joe Trippi, han har skrevet en bok som heter «The Revolution Will Not Be Televised», om hvordan han mener at de ulike trekkene ved nettet vil forandre og revolusjonere valgkampen. Nå kan man jo si at Howard Deans fall I valgkampen ble jo på en måte TV. Så sånn sett så vant TV til slutt I den runden. Men det likevel veldig interessant å se, for hvis du I dag går inn og ser på amerikanske toppolitikere I presidentvalgkampen, så den deltakelseskulturen som det har skapt, og fullstendig forandret måten de driver valgkamp på og bruker nettet, og vi ser også etter hvert sakte, men sikkert, at det I hvert fall I veldig liten grad I Norge, men da inntar andre europeiske land. Men I tillegg til deling og deltaking, så altså utvikling, innovasjon, skaping en viktig del av den iboende kulturen I friprogramvare. Og da det også der, ikke sant, det elementet I seg, at du får en mye raskere spredning av teknologi innenfor økonomifaget, så vet vi at det, altså, graden av spredning av teknologi en viktig indikator for velstandsutvikling og en måte å skape velstand på. Og det iboende I programvare, I tillegg til at det selvsagt har I seg også at man må skape og utvikle selv og bidra til det, de redskapene som man skal bruke. Og det interessante med alt det her, det jo at det ikke bare kulturtrekk ved fri programvare, det et kulturtrekk ved kunnskapssamfunnet I seg selv. Og det betyr at det å få nettopp de kulturtrekka her til å dominere ikke bare nettverdenen, men også skolen, vil bety masse I året fremover. Vi trenger sterkere fokus på deltaking, på deling og på egen innovasjon og utvikling, slik at skolen med på å bringe fram den kulturen. Men det jo også motsatt, for det jo ingen tvil om at rundt omkring I norsk skole, så har vi faktisk mye å lære både av og om barn og unge sin bruk av nettet, enten det spill, eller det ulike sosiale nettverkstjenester, eller det fri programvære. Det foregår en rivende utvikling, så det voldsomt vanskelig for oss å holde tritt med. Og for å gi et eksempel på liksom det litt der vi står I dag, nå det altså sånn at vi kommet opp I en PC-dekning I videregående opplæring, der det 1,8 elever per PC. Utviklingen har gått veldig rask. Det var altså 2,5 elever per PC året før. Nå det 1,8. Vi nærmer oss 1-1. Veldig mange fylker har utstyrt elevene I sitt fylke med en gratis PC. Det litt igjen da før vi helt der, men vi veldig nær. Men, og det et veldig stort men, det ikke alltid står like godt til med, det kompetansen, og bruken. Og derfor har vi altså en kjempe utfordring I å øke kompetansen blant lærere og innenfor skolen på bruken av digitale verktøy. Og vi har en kjempestor utfordring I hvordan vi kan bruke digitale læremidler bedre, hvordan det kan utvikles bedre digitale læremidler, men ikke minst hvordan ting som utvikles på nettet og kulturen fra nettet kan hentes inn og bli en mer naturlig del av bruken av digitale verktøy innenfor skolen. Det är en kjempeutfordring som må være en del av av jobbingen med mot kunnskapssamfunnet framover. Och så är alltså vi har ju alltså vi har stora utmaningar i norsk skole i åra som kommer. Fordi selv om mye veldig bra i skolen, selv om det de fleste elever lærer både å lese og skrive og regne og bruke digitale verktøy og mange andre ting, så det også dramatisk at vi har noen veldig, altså noen ting som bare ikke godt nok. Og jeg skal bruke litt tid her på, på noen av de største utfordringene der. For det første så ser vi at en av fem elever ikke lærer å lese godt nok når jeg går ut av grunnskolen til at jeg kan bruke den informasjonen jeg leser, kunne forstå og fortolke. Vi snakker ikke om analfabetisme, men vi snakker om evnen til, altså ja, la meg gi et eksempel, du har en, får en tekst foran deg, og i den teksten så går det helt tydelig fram at den personen det handler om er livredd. Men det står ikke eksplisitt at han eller hun er redd. Og da er det ganske mange som ikke klarer å fortolke det og bruke, liksom å få det ut av teksten. Så det er en veldig utfordring. Men det andre store utfordringen vår, det er frafallet i videregående skole. I dag så er det altså sånn at rundt 30% av de som begynner på videregående, og det er nesten alle, fullfører ikke i løpet av en femårsperiode. Da har vi også tatt høyde for en del slekk, at man kanskje må kutte ut et år og så videre, men såpass mange fullfører ikke. Det er en kjempeutfordring, særlig i yrkesfag er det veldig mange, og det er også forskjeller mellom kjønn og mellom majoritet og minoritet. Og dette her er ikke minst en stor utfordring for oss som kunnskapssamfunn fremover. For vi vet altså at etterspørselen etter ukvalifisert arbeidskraft kommer til å gå nedover ytterligere i 10 år som kommer. Og så vet vi også det er en veldig sterk sammenheng mellom hvem som lærer elementær lesing og regning på barnetrinnet og frafall i videregående, og det er en sterk sammenheng mellom frafall og hvordan det går i arbeids- og utdanning etterpå. La meg ta et eksempel. Hvis du ser på, unge folk som er mellom 20 og 24 år, så er det av de som har fullført videregående skole, så er det veldig få som står uten arbeid eller utdanning. Av de som ikke har fullført videregående skole, så er det 1 av 4, altså rundt 25%, som står utenfor arbeid og utdanning. Så det er altså en stor utfordring for å få nok arbeidskraft, for å få kvalifisert arbeidskraft, selvsagt også et stort sosialt spørsmål. Og la meg da si litt om mot slutten hva det viktigste vi må gjøre. Det første vi vet nå, det er at tidlig innsats spiller en rolle. Det har vært en for sterk kultur av at man venter og ser, og vi er nødt til å sette inn innsatsen tidlig. Det betyr tettere oppfølging de første årene på barnetrinnet, med en gang følge opp de som sliter, men det betyr også at barnehagesatsingen må komme mye mer i fokus. Bare hvis du går 10 år tilbake igjen, så var det halvparten av alle barn som begynte på skolen som hadde gått i barnehage. Nå er det altså sånn at 95% av alle som begynner på skolen har gått i barnehage. Og vi vet fra en av de internasjonale undersøkelsene nå, og annen forskning, at, barn, at det er en direkte sammenheng mellom det og antallet år i barnehage og resultater i lesing på barnetrinnet. Og det her har vi jo, vi har egentlig vært gjennom en stor barnehagerevolusjon. Jeg husker på SVs partikontor, der jeg jobbet før, så henger en plakat og en ledde stride som den er fra valget i 1977 eller 79. Men på den plakaten så står det barnehageplass til alle. Og det var da liksom hovedvalgkampbudskapet den gangen. Og jeg husker en av mine kolleger som var innom og så den plakaten, han kommenterte litt sånn lakonisk at det var jo voldsomme, disse SV-ene på 70-tallet. Det kunne jo stått barnehageplass til alle barn, i det minste. Men poenget er i hvert fall at ikke mål om alle har ikke vi nådd, men mål om alle barn er vi da så langt unna nå. Men det handler ikke, det er en velferdssatsing, men det handler også om kunnskap. Men det andre vi er nødt til å ta tak i, det er kompetansen i skolen. Vi har veldig mange dyktige og kompetente lærere, men for det første så får vi en stor rekrutteringsutfordring i året fremover. Og den kan vi fort få i begge ender, fordi veldig mange med for eksempel høy kompetanse på realfaget er over 55 år og vil slutte i løpet av de neste årene. Samtidig sliter vi med å rekruttere høy nok kompetanse på noen fagfelt blant yngre, og da er digital kompetanse et eksempel på det, der vi er veldig avhengige av å rekruttere ny og spennende kompetanse inn i skolen. Så det altså også sånn at vi nødt til å se på både lærerutdanning og etter- og videreutdanning for lærere, og andre sider ved hvordan vi skal øke og utvikle kompetansen i skolen. Så det mange andre utfordringer jeg kunne si litt om i skolen, men det også et annet element, og jeg var på denne NHOs årsmiddag i begynnelsen av januar, og da holdt han Bjørn Kjos, han Norwegian-sjefen, han holdt en sånn middagstale da, og det var jo, skole var hovedtema. Og han sier da liksom at, jo liksom, ja, lesing og skriving og alt det der, det jo greit det. Men, hva er det med PISA som gjør PISA interessant, sier han? Jo, liksom hvis Tony PISA hadde vært rett, så hadde jo ingen brydd seg om Tony PISA. Sant? Det er jo fordi det er skjevt, det er noe spennende med det. Det er noe mer, det er også en X-faktor som er viktig. Og når du skal som næringslivsleder, eller hva det er, rekruttere folk for skolen, så vil du ha grunnleggende kompetanse og kunnskapene skal være i orden. Men du vil ha noe mer. Han kalte det da, man må ha guts, var hans svar da. Og det er jeg for så vidt enig i. Men i tillegg så mener jeg altså at det å bringe inn noen av de elementene som vi har diskutert her i dag, og klare å opprettholde det, og styrke det ytterligere. Ta deling, altså undersøkelser viser jo at den norske skolen er flink til å få elever til å samarbeide, lære seg verdien av samarbeid, få kompetanse på det. Alle vet at det trengs i arbeidslivet. Det må vi være fornøyd med at vi har fått til, men vi har ytterligere en vei å gå før det gjennomsyrer skolen og blir enda sterkere. Vi vet også fra internasjonale undersøkelser at norsk skole har elever som er deltakerne, har stor forståelse for demokrati og deltakelse. Det er en stor styrke, men det er klart det vil bli enda viktigere i kunnskapssamfunnet at man stilles krav til deltakelse, at man regner med at man selv må være med å utvikle samfunnet, arbeidsplassen sin, de verktøyene man skal bruke. Og det samme gjelder innovasjon og utvikling. Vi har også en betydelig vei å gå når det gjelder entreprenørskap, at skolen stimulerer til at man skal være en utvikler, og på den måten bidra i skolehverdagen. Så er det altså sånn at det vi driver med, alle vi som jobber med kunnskapssamfunnet, og det gjør Friprogsenteret, og det gjør Kunnskapsdepartementet, folk som jobber i skolen i Norge, og masse, masse andre, helt sikkert mange av dere som sitter her, mange i næringslivet, og så videre. Det vi gjør, det er at vi gjør den absolutt viktigste jobben for Norge som nasjon. Og det er fordi mange mennesker tror, og det er en stor myte, mange mennesker tror at Norge er rik på grunn av oljen vår. Det er feil. Og det kan man faktisk gå til en ganske interessant bok for å finne svaret på. Men hver høst kommer ut en bok som heter Nasjonalbudsjettet, midt i bokhøsten. Alle har lest den. Jeg er 2-3 usikre her på andre rad, så da tar jeg hovedinnholdet for sikkerhets skyld. Nasjonalbudsjettet, det er altså da kommer for min som er statsbudsjettet. Og på side 69, tror jeg det, i nasjonalbudsjettet for 2007, så er det altså en tabell som viser Norges nasjonalformue. En kakediagram, rett og slett, som viser Norges nasjonalformue, hva den består av. Og da kan man se at all olje og gass vi har under bakken i Norge, absolutt alle kjente petroleumsressurser, det utgjør til sammen 4% av Norges nasjonalformue. Så har man også sett på det her, av hele petroleumsfondet, ca. 2000 milliarder kroner, og all annen privat og offentlig kapital, altså alt vi har i banken, som er ikke så mye, og andre har i banken og petroleumsfondet, til sammen, det utgjør da 3% av Norges nasjonalformue. Derimot, humankapitalen, eller vil si det vi har i hodene våre og hendene våre av kunnskap av verdien av vår nåværende og fremtidige arbeidsinnsats, det er 85% av nasjonalformuen. 85%. Så selv små forbedringer i avkastninger på den delen av formuen, en litt bedre skole, en litt bedre bruk av teknologi, litt mer kompetanse hos ansatte i offentlig sektor eller i privat sektor, litt bedre utnyttelse av den kompetansen vi har. Alle de tingene, de virkemidlene, har mye mer å si, fordi humankapitalen den øker i tillegg andel. Så både for verdiskaping og framtidig velferd, og for hva samfunn vi så det det som hovedjobben. Og der vi som jobber direkte med skole, og dere som jobber med fri programvare, på samme lag. Vi på det laget som forbereder framtidens kunnskapssamfunn. Gratulerer igjen med oppstarten. Veldig glad for at du ble invitert. Spennende å være her. Takk for meg.
Ja. Ja, det jo litt spesielt å stå her med selveste sjefen, så jeg skal ikke være fullt så kjepphøy som jeg var i...
Som du pleier å være.
Som jeg pleier å være. Jeg har jo den glede å dele fornavn med den forrige kunnskapsminister, og jeg deler postnummer med denne kunnskapsministeren. Så derfor det en stor glede for oss å overrekke deg, kjære sambygding, en liten oppmerksomhet, og takk for innsatsen. Ja, før vi går over til neste taler, så skal vi ta litt praktisk informasjon. Hovedscenen her vi nå kommer da til å være samlingspunktet for alle plenumsforedragene, eller keynote som det heter på nynorsk. Når det ikke plenumsforedrag, så vil sporet for offentlig sektor være her. De som skal følge sporet openoffice.org, kan nøye seg med å gå inn ved siden av. For strategisporet så gjelder det å finne fram til kjelleren. Det vil være skiltet til alle de ulike delene. Og kjelleren da ut døra her og ned til høyre. Utviklingssporet skal være i femte etasje. Det da ut herfra og opp til høyre. Også det skiltet. Fra arrangøren og partnerens side så vil vi innstendig oppfordre dere om ikke å være enspora. Gå gjerne over på andre spor og hør hvordan folk i den verden har det. Vi har en stram tidsplan i dag. Vi skal prøve å være ganske strikte. Vi nesten on time nå, vi har tatt inn. Men jeg oppfordrer presentatørene til å holde seg innenfor de tidsrammen dere har. For ikke bare vete hvor de utenlandske gjestene bor, jeg vet også hvor dere bor. Sånn det å jobbe i regjeringskvartalet. Da skal vi gå på neste foredragsholde. Zach Grant has been instrumental in the Mozilla Foundation and the Open Source Movement. He has been coaching the next generation of FOSS development. On a weekly basis, he is posting reports on OSI. He's regarded as a veteran in the open source movement, has high understanding of it. He knows about everyone who's worth to know in it, in the open source community. Please welcome Zach Grant.
So with an introduction like that, I'm pretty sure there's someone else named Zach Grant in the audience at this exact moment in time. Now, I think I can just close this. Perfect. This is a brand new, exciting talk, which means if I don't have my own laptop and my speaker's notes, I will die horribly on stage in front of you. Great. So unfortunately, Chris has stolen some of my thunder. I cannot tell you how open source and free software are based around Coke bottles or cargo cults or anything like that, so I'll have to stick to fairly simple facts and figures and ideas. A few months ago, Heidi from the Competence Center asked me to give a keynote at this conference on the topic of what is free software and why change. With a rather lazy feeling, I started writing a general presentation to give an introduction to free software, open source, explain the benefits to the various classes of producer and consumer and so on. And it's a good thing that luck intervened. I think after giving these kinds of talks for the last 6, 7, 8 years, I've gotten a bit lazy and I made some assumptions that are actually wrong. The luck came to me in the form of this man and this university. So this is Reidar Conradi, who's a professor at NTNU and whose name I have probably just butchered the pronunciation of. I happened to run into him and he sent me a bit of research that he and one of his colleagues and one of his students had done. And it went under the rather simple name of adoption of open source in the software industry. I made another mistake. I assumed it would be yet another survey of how widely adopted open source is in a specific region, in this case, Norway. And I avoided reading the paper for a few weeks. When I finally did, I was stunned because instead of focusing on use, he focused on something else. One note, I'll cite a few papers throughout this presentation. If you go to zach.grant.com, go open, then you'll find references to those papers and links. The idea of adoption within the software industry isn't that new. It's even fairly hard to measure. Even actually embedding software components, free software components, is hard to measure. Here's an amusing but somewhat old point in case. I haven't tried this on the new version of Windows, whatever it's called. Thankfully, I haven't had to use Windows in some amount of time. If you go to the Windows command line in XP, and you happen to have a ported copy of the strings command, which goes through a binary looking for human-readable strings, and you ask it to grab all the strings in the Windows standard FTP executable, and you then look for the string regents inside the output, you find something fascinating within Windows. And that is a copyright notice from the University of California, Berkeley, which indicates that there is BSD-licensed code and relatively old Microsoft software. Really fascinating, but it makes the whole issue of measuring things a bit muddy. But in any case, I was really happy to see that Reidar and his colleagues had not focused on use. Instead, they had focused on the key topic of how many companies in Norway were integrating free software components with software they were shipping to customers and solutions they were offering to customers. He and his team also focused on how much revenue was being made. And I would not kill someone, but lately beat someone for some water right about now. Hopefully someone small and weak. Who no one likes. Much better. So, this focus on integration is fascinating. Now, I could tell with my completely non-existent Norwegian that my thunder was stolen by Heidi, who cited some of the same statistics. But damn it, I will be more precise. It's not 50%. It's nearly 50%. It's precisely 46.9% of the organizations, software-developing organizations, that the team surveyed reported that they delivered solutions that integrated free software components. Additionally, in the summary of the paper, they say that more than 30% of the companies distributing these free software solutions generate over 40% of their revenue from these activities. I can slice that data in an interesting and different way. It comes out to this: 89% of those distributing free software-based solutions earn revenue from it. Out of those 89%, 12% of them don't earn revenue from anything else. Those are pretty impressive numbers. If you had asked those same sort of questions 5 years ago in Norway, I expect that you would find a very different picture, one that would be, say, probably maybe 1%, 2%, 3% earns all their money from free software offerings at most. And that might just take into play a few very small, or take into account a few small players. The survey also indicates that a large number participate in free software projects, reporting bugs, helping to develop, and so on. And we know this anecdotally. It's easy to spot lots of Norwegians participating in open source projects, both as developers, core contributors, bug fixers, and so on. We even know a lot of company names. I mean, Trolltech is quite famous outside of Norway. Within Norway, people know companies like Easy Systems and Linpro and so on. One of the projects developed by one of these companies is even a core part of several different key tool stacks, and that is, of course, Qt by Trolltech. These people fall into that 5% of the group who actually have their own open source projects. With all of the companies I know in Norway that have their own open source projects, each of them has multiple projects, which is even more impressive. So knowing this, the interesting why related to free software isn't why should you change. Instead, it's why has so much of the Norwegian software industry already changed? I think the question of adoption is almost moot. Each day, most of us are using free software in some way, shape, or form. Whether it's embedded deep in the bowels of Windows, whether it's surfing Google, whether it is using Firefox, there are many different ways that we end up accessing it. But why hasn't the Norwegian software industry started actively delivering solutions based on it? Well, to understand, let's take a step back and talk about what free software is and what is driving this massive change that we're seeing. So, even for people who aren't programmers, free software is relatively easy to understand to them in some ways. If I say free software, someone knows that it is obviously software of some kind. The free may confuse them, but we'll get to that in a second. Many non-programmers even know some free software by name. Many people use Firefox. It's fairly widely used in Norway. Of course, usage numbers are dwarfed by those in Finland. Try harder, please. Across the globe, there have been more than 500 million downloads. About 20% of the web is being accessed by Firefox. People tend to know it. People know openoffice.org. When I checked into the hotel a few nights ago, surprisingly, the receptionist knew what free software was and knew about openoffice.org. Most people also know about Linux, and most of us use it in some way, shape, or form each day, even though for many people, typically, it's when they're surfing the net. Many, many servers on the web, say roughly 50%, maybe more, are powered by Linux. The part that ends up confusing people is the free part. When I say free to your average person on the street, your average programmer in the cubicle, they think that I mean free as in a free lunch. Instead, I'm talking about four essential freedoms that a software must have associated with it, by a license in most cases, in order for it to be considered free software. These important freedoms are the freedom to run the software, regardless of who you are, where you are, or for what purpose you wish to use the software. Free software does not care if you are in Syria or the United States, even though both Syria and the United States would certainly care about whether or not you're using software from their country in the opposite country. There's also the freedom to study the software so that you can understand what it does, so that programmers can improve their skills as a programmer, but also, very importantly, so that software can be audited, so you can ensure that it does what it promises to do, both intentionally and, in the case of bugs, unintentionally. The freedom to modify the software, to make it more useful for yourself, to fix bugs that you found by studying the software, and to improve it for other people as well. And finally, the key thing, the freedom to share everything that you have received and everything that you have done with the software with other people, with a fee, or without a fee. So that means the freedom to share copies of the software with other people so that they can run it freely. The freedom to share what you have learned about the software. Any number of proprietary software packages have clauses in their licensing that state things like, you may not do benchmarks on this software. And of course, you may not use the software unless you have a license. Well, isn't that great? It really stifles innovation, and it stifles the ability of a market to analyze whether or not a piece of software is a good solution. You also, of course, have the freedom to share your modifications with others. You probably know the term open source. For the purposes of this talk, open source and free software are equivalent. I don't personally have a strong preference. For convenience this time, I've chosen free software. If I say both free software and open source every time, I need an extra 2 glasses of water by the end of the presentation. Open source isn't a bad term. It gets to the core requirement of free software, and that is, if you do not have access to the source code of a piece of software, you can't exert the rights of free software on it. There's another key limit on the freedoms of free software, and this is more of a mechanical limit, a systems-based limit. That is distribution. In a pre-internet era, the cost of sharing software on digital media went from insanely expensive to just fairly expensive. So in the early 1960s, you could count on paying about 100,000 Norwegian crowns per megabyte of data for your storage. And this is large, fragile, difficult to transport, hard to install storage. If you move ahead until, say, the mid-1980s, the late 1980s, maybe the early 90s, when the web is really not emerged, when it is not something that most people are using, even by that point, while the price has radically dropped, it's still not that cheap. You're looking at about 10 crowns per megabyte. So about 10 crowns for a 1.44 megabyte floppy disk. It's a factor of 10,000, but it's still not enough, because even though you have all these rights that free software offers you, you have to put it on a piece of physical medium that you then have to give to someone or mail to them. It ends up behaving much like a physical good would, much like a book would in many ways. Interestingly, in the early days of computing, when digital storage is so expensive, it was much cheaper to distribute source code as plain text, much more so than trying to ship a huge tape to someone. This same dynamic, the cost of storage and how you could get software out to people, created the modern consumer software industry. And it created it because a few different dynamics ran into each other. So one dynamic was that around the mid-80s, you started to find there were many, many different kinds of competing personal computers. They'd become cheap enough for people with a fair chunk of disposable personal income to just buy them. But there was a disparity, because while there are starting to be a good number of computers, there weren't nearly as many programmers who could work on these platforms. So you have all of these different computers out there, many different platforms. Each platform you have to port software from to the other platforms to make, you know, if you have a game like Lode Runner, there would, of course, be a port for Commodore 64 and a port for the VIC-20 and a port for maybe Atari ST later on by some diehard and so on. This really ended up being in the advantage of software companies in those days, because what they had access to was something that was amazing for them. They have access to a broad market that has lots of disposable income and that is accustomed to treating software as if it were a physical good. They're accustomed to treating all ideas as if they're physical goods. It's not that they buy an idea and they get a book with it. It's that they buy a book and their idea's in it. It's much the same with software. You buy a CD, you buy a floppy disk, you buy maybe a tape if you're unlucky, and so on. For them, it was a case of being able to make a product that was knowledge, but treat it as if it were a physical good, when the copying of it cost them basically nothing by the end of the arc of the consumer software era. The cost to a company for a floppy disk is basically zero. They get to build one copy, which, granted, is difficult. Many of us in the audience are software engineers. Building software isn't easy. We get it wrong often. But even so, once you've built it, you can distribute basically as many copies as you want for an incredible markup. As media gets cheaper and cheaper, though, you see companies start to introduce artificial scarcity. By the time you get to the early 90s, there are many programmers. There are many computers. Computers have fallen drastically in price. Physical media has gotten very cheap. But software prices have this magic property of being as expensive or sometimes much, much more expensive in the consumer space. But then something very important happened. And that, of course, is the net. The net changes all of these things. Amusingly enough, my shiny Mac and my shiny proprietary software, Keynote, has this little timer that tells me how long I have, and it is broken for some unknown reason. So when I hit like 15 minutes, start hand waving, please. Not all of you, just 5 or 10 in the front would be great. With the net, and not in the early days, but once you get to, say, a state like today, where it's this monster, absolute monster, the biggest distributed machine we've ever created. It consumes about 5% of our global electricity output. It is a massive thing that we have built. And on this massive thing that we have built, I can ship a piece of software to someone, an idea, a music file, anything, for, say, at a relatively average North American ISP rate, for about 1/10,000th of a Nokia. Wow. So, I'm sure they'll be selling torches and tar and feathers outside at a very inexpensive rate. So, about 1/10,000th of a Norwegian crown per megabyte. But I could pay much less, nothing through Google actually, for a slightly less good service, but all it takes is my time. Well, no, my ISP lets me do stupid things. Google's a much more limited service for hosting websites. But the cost of sharing becomes so low that it's almost effectively zero for people who have a good amount of disposable income. Soon enough, it will be basically zero. The cost of a copy will be nothing. Even now, it's almost so close to nothing that it boggles the mind at how inexpensive it is. Suddenly, it means, because of this incredibly low cost, that we can start treating software, which is really knowledge, just like knowledge again. Something that isn't really tied to a physical form. Something that you can share without diminishing its value in any way. If I share a physical good with you, if I share an apple with you and we each eat half, we each have half. If I share a floppy disk with you, it wears out faster. If I share a copy of bits with you over the net, we both have a copy at the end, and really nothing degrades. Individual pieces do, you know, boards desolder themselves in Google server rooms, but it's just a small part of this giant machine that we end up shuffling a new piece in to replace. The other fascinating thing to consider is that even though physical media has dropped almost correspondingly in price, it's amazing how much you can fit on a tiny chunk of plastic and circuits nowadays, it still isn't as powerful as the net, because the net is broadcast media. On demand, I can go and get a chunk of data. If I want it on a physical piece of media, it has to reach me, which takes time. The other amazing, interesting property of the net is that the cost to share is the same as the cost to get your initial copy. So, compare it to the radio. The radio is about 10 times or 100 times more expensive to share information, and it was our cheapest form of broadcast media until the net. If I record a copy of music played on the radio, I can really only share it with other people in a physical form. And that ends up breaking the distribution effect of the radio, unless I have another radio station, which I don't because they're state-granted monopolies on radio stations. So the net has a property of sharing more easily than basically any other media we have, combined with being more cheap at the same time. It also displaces all these previous forms of media we have. Not the channels. We don't replace the wires in the ground, the satellites in the air, and so on, but we can ship basically radio, television, anything over the net that renders reasonably well as a stream of bits. This is not a minor change. This is a fundamental rewriting of how we see the value of goods, any knowledge good, in our society. This little chart shows an interesting effect of the net. It's from some research done by a couple of guys from SAP Labs, and it's tracking when 5,000 individual open source projects were developed. This is when the first commit starts. And you see that nice exponential curve? We see that in basically every other study that is similar. The amount of open source software is growing exponentially, much like the amount of power is growing in transistors and computers exponentially. It's a massive change, and it's happening in this distributed way. There's no one coordinated entity driving it. It's all of us working towards our various individual goals to reach some end that we hardly even understand. The interesting thing is that many of these parties have no real connection. You can have distributed collaboration between people who never meet, never talk. They just share their software under some permissive license over the net, which basically then means no cost to share it, and interesting things happen. Networks emerge that you never would expect to emerge. This changes the dynamics of the software industry. The artificial and real scarcity that drove tremendous profits for 15 years and still drives them now. Microsoft is incredibly rich. They keep getting richer. Many other companies are as well. But that dynamic is being changed. Right now, it's a series of social mechanisms that keep it in place and business mechanisms rather than the underlying infrastructure that distributes the software. So if you understand this, you're probably thinking, half of the Norwegian software companies are all geniuses for just switching. And there actually are a lot of really smart people in the Norwegian software industry. But I think most Norwegian software companies are like most software companies around the world. They're worried about the day-to-day things. They're worried about making their earnings look good for the next quarter. They're worried about having enough money in the bank for the Christmas party and so on. The reasons that they're adopting free software and using it tend to be fairly simple and pragmatic. Chris spoke about why people build free software as individuals. Well, here's why companies tend to adopt it as organizations. Right at the top of the list is reduced TCO, because it's one thing that drives you to look. If your budget has shrunk, but you still are expected to do the same amount of work, you're going to look fairly hard for some way to do it. And it's pretty easy to have someone tell you about how some piece of software has saved them a bunch of time, which is why you see LAMP servers popping up all over the place. Incredibly cheap, incredibly effective, broad set of tools that solve a whole range of business issues. And you could use it on commodity hardware that you've had sitting in your server room for 3 years doing nothing. The TCO comes from many spaces. People think that it's just the free licensing, the no-cost licensing. But that's only a tiny part of total cost of ownership. It's the fact that you can choose your support relationship with this vast group of, not really vendors, but this vast community. You can go, say you're using Apache, you can go all the way from passively searching the web to look for articles that people have written, to going to the support forums and searching them, to asking questions on the support forums, to paying a company to give you support, and there are lots of companies who will do it quite happily, and all the way from people who have no engagement in the development process to core developers involved in these companies. You get to choose a scale that fits for you instead of, well, say Oracle were free to pick on a company. Well, Oracle can only provide you support at a given cost, a cost that is probably too much for many of the potential people who could use it. An interesting example of this is from the French tax office. They've started a project to retool their tax infrastructure for all French citizens. Massive project, multi-billion dollars, multiple years. For the software component, they have seen an 80% total cost of ownership reduction. 80%. The amazing thing, and this reflects back to what Chris said earlier, is the difference in service experience. They worked with a combination of vendors outside France and small companies in France. For the small company in France, set of small companies in France, they provided the support offering for the project. The requirements the French government had for them would terrify any large proprietary vendor. No bug shall remain open longer than 48 hours. We shall never have to upgrade to a major version to put the bug fix in place. And we shall contribute all fixes back to the community to do with what they see fit. I was at a CTO, government CTO conference, when I saw the presentation on this, and it was amazing. This presentation was a filter because it was a mix of government CIOs and CTOs and the vendors that support them. And all of the CTOs leaned forward with their mouths hanging open, and all of the vendors sort of looked small and nervous because you can't compete with that service offering at 4/5 cheaper than what, well, you can offer. So people also choose, companies choose to build software that includes free software components because of market requirements. There are many, many pieces of software, proprietary pieces of software, that are built to interact with MySQL. And there are many hybrid versions, so a mix of, say, dual licensing, free software, maybe a proprietary version as well. They're built to use MySQL because MySQL is so prevalent. The entire LAMP stack is prevalent. If you look at standard out-of-the-box ISP offerings, what do you see? Typically, if they have multiple offers, you're looking at a Windows offer, and a Linux offer, and the Linux offer includes Linux, Apache, PHP, MySQL, the whole deep, broad, open source tool stack at a fraction of the cost of the Windows offering, at least for licensing purposes. Once we move up this hierarchy from, you know, just being hungry and trying to survive to doing what is forced on you by a market, you get companies thinking about risk management. If you need to use a large piece of software and build on top of it, say you need an entire operating system for your venture. Who do you want to have controlling that? One company or a community that you can participate in? Smart vendors put their money on open source and free software because it means that they are not beholden to Microsoft when Microsoft decides that 3% of the market is not enough to care about. Or 0.3 or 0.000001% like many of us. The other interesting thing is that people tend to choose it for the reason of competition. And sometimes this is cooperative competition, in that you have a group of companies working together, sometimes even unintentionally, with other projects, with nonprofit organizations, to rebalance a market. This can be something like, say, OpenOffice, which is spearheaded by Sun, but has many contributors. And it's working to redress the the imbalance brought about by Microsoft having dominance on the Office platform. Of course, that seems to be a rather long process given what's going on with OpenXML right now. Apparently, there's a demonstration later today, near here, which is fascinating. So, oh, is it tomorrow? Cool. So, I can't really say shame to anyone in this audience, I suspect, but if I could, I really would. I'd waggle the finger really hard. The other reason that you see groups adopting free software, and there are many other reasons as well, but you often see market failure as being a key driver in what people do with free software. A good example comes with OpenOffice again, and how when Microsoft did not provide localized versions for Sami, for Nynorsk, the OpenOffice community, Norwegians, Sami speakers, got together, and they did. And lo and behold, Office suddenly had a localization for both of these things shortly after. The market addresses weaknesses that it sees that need to be fixed. I think I've hit enough on the distributes control, and I want to hit that 5-minute mark. Ah, Norwegian artwork. Does everyone feel happy? Does anyone feel nervous thinking about their business model evaporating? Copies are free, software has no value except for creation. It's not really that pleasant to look out and think the model is changing. But why should we be too attached to the old model? It's young. It's very young. And it's a strange model that only exists when you have the right set of conditions. When you have scarcity plus demand plus an unknown space. We're moving to a state that we seem to get to with most bits of knowledge. With the printing press, with the construction industry, with laws, with so many different things that are public knowledge. We end up having a community of experts that know more about these bits of public knowledge than your average citizen. And we pay them and their organizations often very well to apply that knowledge as best they can. Lawyers deal with public information. The laws are public for any of us to read. We can even defend ourselves in court should the need arise. However, very few of us choose to do that because we are not experts. And us defending ourselves in court is possibly going to lead to one of the worst outcomes we could hope for rather than one of the best. So what do people pay for when copies cost nothing? And this is blatantly stolen from a brilliant short essay by Kevin Kelly that I'll mention at the end. I've condensed it a bit, and I have slightly different views. People pay for basically four things. They pay for availability, for having the software or the knowledge good where they need it, when they need it, in the form they need it, and in a form that they can find later on. Google's brilliance is that it helps you find what's on the web. It's not that they created any of the content. Well, Google does everything now. They did create some of the content, but the main bulk of things is that they help you find what is out there. Because the thing that people are constrained on right now is not money. It's not having the content. It's having the attention and time to find it. And Google saves you attention and time. And people are willing to pay for that in certain circumstances. People tend to pay for relationships. And this is a fairly broad category. They pay for social meaning. They pay for brands that make them fit in better with their chosen community. They pay for security. They pay for trust. They want a vendor that they can know has taken appropriate steps to protect their privacy online. They also pay for patronage. The bet that in the future you will make more things that they want. So they want you to be happy now so you can keep creating. People will pay a tremendous amount for personalization, for making an existing good do what they need it to do, above and beyond what the common good does. And this is how a lot of open source and free software gets created. An existing package is extended, it's customized for one person, and some set of that customization is released into the general community again. And finally, people pay for material copies. They pay to take that great high-resolution Creative Commons licensed image on Flickr and turn it into a poster for their wall. Because there, the copy has meaning again. A physical copy has a meaning that a virtual copy does not. Like I say, go read it, better than free. It'll change your business model. And one last thought when I have 30 seconds left. We each know something of the history of the printing press. We know that starting in the 15th century and over a period of about 200 years, it set the foundations for fundamentally rewriting how societies began to work. And this is because it let knowledge be shared so much more cheaply than at any other point in time in the past. With a newspaper, you can share one word with one person for about and I won't do the conversion on the fly because I'd hate to mess up, 1/100,000th of a cent when the newspaper is a mature technology. So we're talking about nowadays. It was more expensive in the past. Incredibly cheap. It provided a lifeblood for people to discuss natures of society and how society should work. It is the birthplace of democracy. It will eventually lead to real free societies, which we don't have yet, but maybe we can see them from here. It took the press 300 to 400 years to basically travel around most of the populated world. The net has done the same in my lifetime. It's tremendously huge now. Right now it has, we roughly guess, Kevin Kelly guesses, about the power of, say, in some measures, 5 human brains. It's amazing. It may not seem like much, but for a machine, that's incredible. And at the rate it's growing, it'll end up becoming the most important machine that we've ever built until something new and better replaces it. As writing, as the printing press, as books are the base of our society now, and as they radically transformed our society, the net will radically transform society even more. The net is our modern printing press, and free software, these are our modern books. Keep that in mind when you're planning your business strategies, but also when you're thinking about what free software means to society. I have no time for questions. I am 1 minute and 18 seconds over, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah, I really loved your Freudian slip about the mobile vendor whose name is not to be mentioned.
It would have been funnier in Finland.
probably. So, guys, thank you very much for two very stimulating keynotes. We have now my assistant, Mr. Gunnarsson, will now hand over some token of appreciation. So, big applause.
Many thanks.
Da det pause, neste sesjon, de ulike sporene starter 10:10. Neste plenum 10:04. We wish you hell and luck.